If I get wrong in my reasoning, recollect, it is you who adopted the analogy.
Very lately, said Margaret, I heard a story of what happened in Nuremberg only 3 or 4 years ago. A rich man there lived alone in one of the immense mansions, which were formerly both dwellings and warehouses. It was reported that he had a child, but no one knew of it for certain. For 40 years this rumour kept rising and falling, never utterly dying away. After his death it was found to be true. He had a son, an overgrown man with the unexercised intellect of a child, whom he had kept up in that strange way in order to save him from temptation and error. But, of course, when this great old child was turned loose into the world, every bad counsellor had power over him. He did not know good from evil. His father had made the blunder of bringing him up in ignorance and taking it for innocence, and after 14 months of riotous living, the city authorities had to take charge of him in order to save him from starvation. He could not even use words effectively enough to be a successful beggar. I used the comparison, suggested by Miss Hale, of the position of the master to that of a parent, so I ought not to complain of your turning the simile into a weapon against me. But, Mr. Hale, when you were setting up a wise parent as a model for us, you said he humoured his children in their desire for independent action. Now, certainly, the time has not come for the hands to have any independent action during business hours. I hardly know what you would mean by it, then. And I say that the masters would be trenching on the independence of their hands in a way that I, for one, should not feel justified in doing if we interfered too much with the life they lead out of the mills. Because they labour 10 hours a day for us, I do not see that we have any right to impose leading strings upon them for the rest of their time. I value my own independence so highly that I can fancy no degradation greater than that of having another man perpetually directing and advising and lecturing me, or even planning too closely in any way about my actions. He might be the wisest of men, or the most powerful. I should equally rebel and resent his interference. I imagine this is a stronger feeling in the north of England than in the south.
I beg your pardon, but is not that because there has been none of the equality of friendship between the adviser and advised classes? Because every man has had to stand in an unchristian and isolated position, apart from and jealous of his brother man, constantly afraid of his rights being trenched upon?
I only state the fact. I am sorry to say I have an appointment at 8 o'clock, and I must just take facts as I find them tonight, without trying to account for them, which indeed would make no difference in determining how to act as things stand. The facts must be granted.
But, said Margaret in a low voice, it seems to me that it makes all the difference in the world.
Her father made a sign to her to be silent and allow Mr. Thornton to finish what he had to say. He was already standing up and preparing to go. You must grant me this one point. Given a strong feeling of independence in every Derbyshire man, have I any right to obtrude my views of the manner in which he shall act upon another, hating it as I should do most vehemently myself, merely because he has labour to sell and I capital to buy?
Not in the least, said Margaret, determined just to say this one thing. Not in the least because of your labour and capital positions, whatever they are, but because you are a man dealing with a set of men over whom you have, whether you reject the use of it or not, immense power, just because your lives and your welfare are so constantly and intimately interwoven. God has made us so that we must be mutually dependent. We may ignore our own dependence, or refuse to acknowledge that others depend upon us in more respects than the payment of weekly wages. But the thing must be, nevertheless. Neither you nor any other master can help yourselves. The most proudly independent man depends on those around him for their insensible influence on his character, his life. And the most isolated of all your Derbyshire egos has dependents clinging to him on all sides. He cannot shake them off, any more than the great rock he resembles can shake off,
"Pray don't go into similes, Margaret. You have led us off once already," said her father, smiling, yet uneasy at the thought that they were detaining Mr. Thornton against his will, which was a mistake. But he rather liked it, as long as Margaret would talk, although what she said only irritated him. "Just tell me, Miss Hale, are you yourself ever influenced? No, that is not a fair way of putting it. But if you are ever conscious of being influenced by others, and not by circumstances, have those others been working directly or indirectly? Have they been labouring to exhort, to enjoin, to act rightly for the sake of example, or have they been simple, true men, taking up their duty and doing it unflinchingly, without a thought of how their actions were to make this man industrious, that man saving? Why, if I were a workman, I should be 20 times more impressed by the knowledge that my master was honest, punctual, quick, resolute in all his doings, and hands are keener spies even than valets, than by any amount of interference, however kind they meant, with my ways of going on out of work hours. I do not choose to think too closely on what I am myself, but I believe I rely on the straightforward honesty of my hands and the open nature of their opposition, in contradistinction to the way in which the turnout will be managed in some mills, just because they know I scorn to take a single dishonourable advantage, or do an underhand thing myself. It goes farther than a whole course of lectures on honesty as the best policy, life diluted into words. No, no. What the master is, that will the men be, without overmuch taking thought on his part.
That is a great admission, said Margaret, laughing. When I see men violent and obstinate in pursuit of their rights, I may safely infer that the master is the same, that he is a little ignorant of that spirit which suffereth long and is kind and seeketh not her own.
You are just like all strangers who don't understand the working of our system, Miss Hale, said he hastily. You suppose that our men are puppets of dough, ready to be moulded into any amiable form we please. You forget we have only to do with them for less than a third of their lives, and you seem not to perceive that the duties of a manufacturer are far larger and wider than those merely of an employer of labour. We have a wide commercial character to maintain, which makes us into the great pioneers of civilization. It strikes me, said Mr. Hale, smiling, that you might pioneer a little at home. They are a rough, heathenish set of fellows, these Milton men of yours.
They are that, replied Mr. Thornton. Rosewater surgery won't do for them. Cromwell would have made a capital mill owner, Miss Hale. I wish we had him to put down this strike for us.
Cromwell is no hero of mine, said she coldly, but I am trying to reconcile your admiration of despotism with your respect for other men's independence of character.
He reddened at her tone. I choose to be the unquestioned and irresponsible master of my hands during the hours they labour for me. But those hours past, our relation ceases, and then comes in the same respect for their independence that I myself exact.
He did not speak again for a minute. He was too much vexed, but he shook it off and bade Mr. and Mrs. Hale good night. Then, drawing near to Margaret, he said in a lower voice,
I spoke hastily to you once this evening, and I am afraid rather rudely. But you know I am but an uncouth Milton manufacturer. Will you forgive me?
Certainly, said she, smiling up in his face, the expression of which was somewhat anxious and oppressed, and hardly cleared away as he met her sweet sunny countenance, out of which all the north wind effect of their discussion had entirely vanished. But she did not put out her hand to him, and again he felt the omission and set it down to pride. Chapter 16. The Shadow of Death. Trust in that veiled hand which leads none by the path that he would go, and always be for change prepared, for the world's law is ebb and flow. From the Arabic. The next afternoon, Dr. Donaldson came to pay his first visit to Mrs. Hale. The mystery that Margaret hoped their late habits of intimacy had broken through was resumed. She was excluded from the room while Dixon was admitted.
Margaret was not a ready lover, but where she loved passionately, and with no small degree of jealousy. She went into her mother's bedroom, just behind the drawing room, and paced it up and down, while awaiting the doctor's coming out. Every now and then she stopped to listen. She fancied she heard a moan. She clenched her hands tight and held her breath. She was sure she heard a moan. Then all was still for a few minutes more. And then there was the moving of chairs, the raised voices, all the little disturbances of leave-taking. When she heard the door open, she went quickly out of the bedroom. "My father is from home, Dr. Donaldson. He has to attend a pupil at this hour. May I trouble you to come into his room downstairs?" She saw and triumphed over all the obstacles which Dixon threw in her way, assuming her rightful position as daughter of the house in something of the spirit of the elder brother, which quelled the old servant's officiousness very effectually. Margaret's conscious assumption of this unusual dignity of demeanour towards Dixon gave her an instant's amusement in the midst of her anxiety. She knew, from the surprised expression on Dixon's face, how ridiculously grand she herself must be looking, and the idea carried her downstairs into the room. It gave her that length of oblivion from the keen sharpness of the recollection of the actual business in hand. Now that came back and seemed to take away her breath. It was a moment or two before she could utter a word. But she spoke with an air of command as she asked, "What is the matter with Mama? You will oblige me by telling the simple truth." Then seeing a slight hesitation on the doctor's part, she added, "I am the only child she has. Here, I mean. My father is not sufficiently alarmed, I fear. And therefore, if there is any serious apprehension, it must be broken to him gently. I can do this. I can nurse my mother. Pray speak, sir. To see your face and not be able to read it gives me a worse dread than I trust any words of yours will justify."
"My dear young lady, your mother seems to have a most attentive and efficient servant, who is more like her friend."
"I am her daughter, sir."
"But when I tell you she expressly desired that you might not be told."
"I am not good or patient enough to submit to the prohibition. Besides, I am sure you are too wise, too experienced to have promised to keep the secret."
"Well," said he, half smiling, though sadly enough, "there you are right. I did not promise. In fact, I fear the secret will be known soon enough without my revealing it."
He paused. Margaret went very white and compressed her lips a little more. Otherwise, not a feature moved. With the quick insight into character, without which no medical man can rise to the eminence of Dr. Donaldson, he saw that she would exact the full truth, that she would know if one iota was withheld, and that the withholding would be torture more acute than the knowledge of it. He spoke two short sentences in a low voice, watching her all the time. For the pupils of her eyes dilated into a black horror, and the whiteness of her complexion became livid. He ceased speaking. He waited for that look to go off, for her gasping breath to come. Then she said, "I thank you most truly, sir, for your confidence. That dread has haunted me for many weeks. It is a true, real agony. My poor, poor mother." Her lips began to quiver, and he let her have the relief of tears, sure of her power of self-control to check them. A few tears, those were all she shed, before she recollected the many questions she longed to ask. "Will there be much suffering?" He shook his head.
"That we cannot tell. It depends on constitution, on a thousand things. But the late discoveries of medical science have given us large power of alleviation."
"My father," said Margaret, trembling all over.
"I do not know, Mr. Hale. I mean, it is difficult to give advice. But I should say bear on, with the knowledge you have forced me to give you so abruptly, till the fact which I could not withhold has become in some degree familiar to you, so that you may, without too great an effort, be able to give what comfort you can to your father. Before then, my visits, which of course I shall repeat from time to time, although I fear I can do nothing but alleviate,
The thousand little circumstances will have occurred to awaken his alarm, to deepen it, so that he will be all the better prepared. Nay, my dear young lady, nay, my dear, I saw Mr. Thornton, and I honour your father for the sacrifice he has made, however mistaken I may believe him to be. Well, this once, if it will please you, my dear, only remember when I come again, I come as a friend, and you must learn to look upon me as such, because seeing each other, getting to know each other at such times as these, is worth years of morning calls. Margaret could not speak for crying, but she wrung his hand at parting. "That's what I call a fine girl," thought Dr. Donaldson, when he was seated in his carriage and had time to examine his ringed hand, which had slightly suffered from her pressure. Who would have thought that little hand could have given such a squeeze? But the bones were well put together, and that gives immense power. What a queen she is! With her head thrown back at first to force me into speaking the truth, and then bent so eagerly forward to listen. Poor thing! I must see she does not overstrain herself, though it's astonishing how much those thoroughbred creatures can do and suffer. That girl's game to the backbone. Another, who had gone that deadly colour, could never have come round without either fainting or hysterics. But she wouldn't do either, not she. And the very force of her will brought her round. Such a girl as that would win my heart if I were 30 years younger. It's too late now. Ah, here we are at the Archers. So out he jumped, with thought, wisdom, experience, sympathy, and ready to attend to the calls made upon them by this family, just as if there were none other in the world. Meanwhile, Margaret had returned into her father's study for a moment to recover strength before going upstairs into her mother's presence.
"Oh, my God, but this is terrible. How shall I bear it? Such a deadly disease. No hope. Oh, Mama, Mama, I wish I had never gone to Aunt Shaw's and been all those precious years away from you. Poor Mama, how much she must have borne. Oh, I pray thee, my God, that her sufferings may not be too acute, too dreadful. How shall I bear to see them? How can I bear Papa's agony? He must not be told yet, not all at once. It would kill him. But I won't lose another moment of my own dear precious mother."
She ran upstairs. Dixon was not in the room. Mrs. Hale lay back in an easy chair with a soft white shawl wrapped around her, and a becoming cap put on in expectation of the doctor's visit. Her face had a little faint colour in it, and the very exhaustion after the examination gave it a peaceful look. Margaret was surprised to see her look so calm.
"Why, Margaret, how strange you look. What is the matter?"
And then, as the idea stole into her mind of what was indeed the real state of the case, she added, as if a little displeased,
"You have not been seeing Dr. Donaldson and asking him any questions, have you, child?"
Margaret did not reply, only looked wistfully towards her. Mrs. Hale became more displeased.
"He would not surely break his word to me and—"
"Oh, yes, Mama, he did. I made him. It was I. Blame me."
She knelt down by her mother's side and caught her hand. She would not let it go, though Mrs. Hale tried to pull it away. She kept kissing it, and the hot tears she shed bathed it.
"Margaret, it was very wrong of you. You knew I did not wish you to know."
But as if tired with the contest, she left her hand in Margaret's clasp, and by she returned the pressure faintly. That encouraged Margaret to speak.
"Oh, Mama, let me be your nurse. I will learn anything Dixon can teach me. But you know I am your child, and I do think I have a right to do everything for you."
"You don't know what you are asking," said Mrs. Hale with a shudder.
"Yes, I do. I know a great deal more than you are aware of. Let me be your nurse. Let me try, at any rate. No one has ever, shall ever try so hard as I will do. It will be such a comfort, Mama."
"My poor child. Well, you shall try. Do you know, Margaret, Dixon and I thought you would quite shrink from me if you knew."
"Dixon thought," said Margaret, her lip curling.
Dixon could not give me credit for enough true love, for as much as herself. She thought, I suppose, but I was one of those poor sickly women who like to lie on rose leaves and be fanned all day. Don't let Dixon's fancies come any more between you and me, Mama. Don't, please, implored she. Don't be angry with Dixon, said Mrs. Hale anxiously. Margaret recovered herself. No, I won't. I will try and be humble and learn her ways, if you will only let me do all I can for you. Let me be in the first place, Mother. I am greedy of that. I used to fancy you would forget me while I was away at Aunt Shaw's, and cry myself to sleep at nights with that notion in my head. And I used to think, how will Margaret bear our makeshift poverty after the thorough comfort and luxury in Harley Street, till I have many a time been more ashamed of your seeing our contrivances at Helston than of any stranger finding them out. Oh, Mama, and I did so enjoy them. They were so much more amusing than all the jot-trot Harley Street ways. The wardrobe shelf with handles that served as a supper tray on grand occasions, and the old tea-chest stuffed and covered for ottomans. I think what you call the makeshift contrivances at dear Helston were a charming part of the life there. I shall never see Helston again, Margaret, said Mrs. Hale, the tears welling up in her eyes. Margaret could not reply. Mrs. Hale went on. While I was there, I was forever wanting to leave it. Every place seemed pleasanter, and now I shall die far away from it. I am rightly punished. You must not talk so, said Margaret impatiently. He said you might live for years. Oh, Mother, we will have you back at Helston yet. No, never. That I must take as a just penance. But Margaret, Frederick. At the mention of that one word, she suddenly cried out loud, as in some sharp agony. It seemed as if the thought of him upset all her composure, destroyed the calm, overcame the exhaustion. Wild, passionate cry succeeded to cry, Frederick, Frederick, come to me, I am dying. Little first-born child, come to me once again. She was in violent hysterics. Margaret went and called Dixon in terror. Dixon came in a huff and accused Margaret of having overexcited her mother. Margaret bore all meekly, only trusting that her father might not return. In spite of her alarm, which was even greater than the occasion warranted, she obeyed all Dixon's directions promptly and well, without a word of self-justification. By so doing, she mollified her accuser. They put her mother to bed, and Margaret sate by her till she fell asleep, and afterwards till Dixon beckoned her out of the room, and with a sour face, as if doing something against the grain, she bade her drink a cup of coffee, which she had prepared for her in the drawing-room, and stood over her in a commanding attitude as she did so. "You shouldn't have been so curious, miss, and then you wouldn't have needed to fret before your time. It would have come soon enough. And now I suppose you'll tell master, and a pretty household I shall have of you." "No, Dixon," said Margaret sorrowfully, "I will not tell Papa. He could not bear it as I can." And by way of proving how well she bore it, she burst into tears. I knew how it would be. Now you'll waken your mamma, just after she's gone to sleep so quietly. Miss Margaret, my dear, I've had to keep it down this many a week, and though I don't pretend I can love her as you do, yet I loved her better than any other man, woman, or child. No one but Master Frederick ever came near her in my mind. Ever since Lady Beresford's maid first took me in to see her dressed out in white crepe and corn ears and scarlet poppies, and I ran a needle down into my finger and broke it in, and she tore up her worked pocket handkerchief after they'd cut it out and came in to wet the bandages again with lotion when she returned from the ball, where she'd been the prettiest young lady of all. I've never loved anyone like her. I little thought then that I should live to see her brought so low. I don't mean no reproach to nobody. Many a one calls you pretty and handsome and what not. Even in this smoky place, enough to blind one's eyes, the owls can see that. But you'll never be like your mother for beauty, never, not if you live to be 100. Mama is very pretty still, poor Mama.
Now don't ye set off again, or I shall give way at last, whimpering. You'll never stand master's coming home and questioning at this rate. Go out and take a walk, and come in something like. Many's the time I've longed to walk it up, the thought of what was the matter with her, and how it must all end.
Oh, Dixon, said Margaret, how often I've been cross with you, not knowing what a terrible secret you had to bear.
Bless you, child. I like to see you showing a bit of spirit. It's the good old Beresford blood. Why, the last Sir John but two shot his steward down, there where he stood, for just telling him that he'd racked the tenants, and he'd racked the tenants till he could get no more money off them than he could get a skin off a flint. Well, Dixon, I won't shoot you, and I'll try not to be cross again. You never have. If I've said it at times, it has always been to myself, just in private, by way of making a little agreeable conversation, for there's no one here fit to talk to. And when you fire up, you're the very image of Master Frederick. I could find in my heart to put you in a passion any day, just to see his stormy look coming like a great cloud over your face. But now, you go out, miss. I'll watch over missus. And as for Master, his books are company enough for him, if he should come in.
I will go, said Margaret.
She hung about Dixon for a minute or so, as if afraid and irresolute. Then suddenly kissing her, she went quickly out of the room. Bless her, said Dixon. She's as sweet as a nut. There are three people I love. It's Mrs., Master Frederick, and her. Just them three. That's all. The rest be hanged, for I don't know what they're in the world for. Master was born, I suppose, but to marry Mrs. If I thought he loved her properly, I might get to love him in time. But he should have made a deal more on her, and not been always reading, reading, thinking, thinking. See what it has brought him to? Many a one who never reads nor thinks either gets to be rector and dean and what not, and I dare say Master might, if he'd just minded Missus and let the weary reading and thinking alone. There she goes, looking out of the window as she heard the front door shut. Poor young lady. Her clothes look shabby to what they did when she came to Helston a year ago. Then she hadn't so much as a darned stocking or a clean pair of gloves in all her wardrobe. And now...
Chapter 17. What is a strike? There are briars besetting every path which call for patient care. There is a cross in every lot and an earnest need for prayer. Anon. Margaret went out heavily and unwillingly enough, but the length of a street, yes, the air of a Milton street, cheered her young blood before she reached her first turning. Her step grew lighter, her lip redder. She began to take notice, instead of having her thoughts turned so exclusively inward. She saw unusual loiterers in the streets, men with their hands in their pockets sauntering along, loud laughing and loud-spoken girls clustered together, apparently excited to high spirits and a boisterous independence of temper and behaviour. The more ill-looking of the men, the discreditable minority, hung about on the steps of the beer-houses and gin-shops, smoking and commenting pretty freely on every passer-by. Margaret disliked the prospect of the long walk through these streets before she came to the fields which she had planned to reach. Instead, she would go and see Bessie Higgins. It would not be so refreshing as a quiet country walk, but still, it would perhaps be doing the kinder thing. Nicholas Higgins was sitting by the fire smoking as she went in. Bessie was rocking herself on the other side. Nicholas took the pipe out of his mouth, and standing up pushed his chair towards Margaret. He leant against the chimney-piece in a lounging attitude while she asked Bessie how she was.
Who's rather down in the mouth in regard to spirits, but who's better in health? Who doesn't like this strike? Who's a deal too much set on peace and quietness at any price?
This is the third strike I've seen, said she, sighing, as if that was answer and explanation enough.
Well, third time pays for all. See if we don't dang the masters this time. See if they don't come and beg us to come back at our own price. That's all. We've missed it aforetime, I grant you, but this time Wynne laid our plans desperate deep.
"Why do you strike?" asked Margaret. "Striking is leaving off work till you get your own rate of wages, is it not? You must not wonder at my ignorance. Where I come from, I never heard of a strike."
"I wish I were there," said Bessie wearily. "But it's not for me to get sick and tired of strikes. This is the last I'll see. Before it's ended, I shall be in the great city, the holy Jerusalem."
"Whoso followed the life to come, who cannot think of the present. Now I, you see, am bound to do the best I can here. I think a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So them's the different views we take on the strike question."
"But," said Margaret, "if the people struck, as you call it, where I come from, as they are mostly all field labourers, the seed would not be sown, the hay got in, the corn reaped."
"Well," said he.
He had resumed his pipe and put his "well" in the form of an interrogation. "Why," she went on, "what would become of the farmers?" He puffed away.
"I reckon they'd have either to give up their farms or to give their rate of wage."
"Suppose they could not, or would not, do the last. They could not give up their farms all in a minute, however much they might wish to do so. But they would have no hay, no corn to sell that year. And where would the money come from to pay the labourers' wages the next?" Still puffing away, at last he said,
"I know nowt of your ways down south. I have heard they're a pack of spiritless downtrodden men. Well, he clemmed to death, too much dazed with clemming to know when they're put upon. Now it's not so here. We known when we're put upon, and we end too much blood in us to stand it. We just take our hands from our looms and say, 'You may clem us, but you'll not put upon us, my masters, and be danged to 'em, they shan't this time.'"
"I wish I lived down south," said Bessie. "There's a deal to bear there," said Margaret. "There are sorrows to bear everywhere. There is very hard bodily labour to be gone through, with very little food to give strength." "But it's out of doors," said Bessie, "and away from the endless, endless noise and sickening heat. It's sometimes in heavy rain and sometimes in bitter cold. A young person can stand it, but an old man gets racked with rheumatism and bent and withered before his time. Yet he must just work on the same, or else go to the workhouse. I thought you were so taken with the ways of the South Country."
"So I am," said Margaret, smiling a little as she found herself thus caught.
"I only mean, Bessie, there's good and bad in everything in this world. And as you felt the bad up here, I thought it was but fair you should know the bad down there."
"And you say they never strike down there?" asked Nicholas abruptly.
"No," said Margaret, "I think they have too much sense."
"And I think," replied he, dashing the ashes out of his pipe with so much vehemence that it broke, "it's not that they have too much sense, but that they have too little spirit."
"Oh, father," said Bessie, "what have ye gained by striking? Think of that first strike when mother died. How we all had to clem, you the worst of all. And yet many a one went in every week at the same wage till all were gone, in that there was work for. And some went beggars all their lives at after."
"Aye," said he, "that there strike was badly managed. Folk got into the management of it, as were either fools or not true men. You'll see it'll be different this time."
"But all this time you've not told me what you're striking for," said Margaret again.
"Why, you see, there's 5 or 6 masters who have set themselves again paying the wages they've been paying these 2 years past, and flourishing upon, and getting richer upon. And now they come to us and say we're to take less, and we won't. We'll just clem them to death first, and see who'll work for 'em then. They'll have killed the goose that laid 'em the golden eggs, I reckon."
"And so you plan dying in order to be revenged upon them?"
"No," said he, "I dunnot. I just look forward to the chance of dying at my post sooner than yield. That's what folk call fine and honourable in a soldier, and why not in a poor weaver chap?"
"But," said Margaret, "a soldier dies in the cause of the nation, in the cause of others."
He laughed grimly. "My lass," said he, "you're but a young wench,
But don't you think I can keep three people? That's Bessie and Mary and me, on 16 shillings a week. Don't you think that's for myself I'm striking work at this time? It's just as much in the cause of others as yon soldier. Only mappin' the cause he dies for is just that of somebody he never clapped eyes on, nor heared on all his born days, while I take up John Boucher's cause, as lives next door but one, with a sickly wife and 8 childer, none on 'em factory age. And I don't take up his cause only, though he's a poor good-for-naught as can only manage 2 looms at a time, but I take up the cause of justice. Why are we to have less wage now, I ask, than 2 year ago? Don't ask me, said Margaret. I am very ignorant. Ask some of your masters. Surely they will give you a reason for it. It is not merely an arbitrary decision of theirs, come to without reason. You're just a foreigner, and nothing more, said he contemptuously. Much you know about it. Ask the masters. They'd tell us to mind our own business, and they'd mind theirs. Our business being, you understand, to take the baited wage and be thankful, and their business to bait us down to Clemming Point to swell their profits. That's what it is.
But, said Margaret, determined not to give way, although she saw she was irritating him, the state of trade may be such as not to enable them to give you the same remuneration.
State of trade? That's just a piece of master's humbug. It's rate of wages I was talking of. The masters keep the state of trade in their own hands, and just walk it forward like a black bugaboo to frighten naughty children with into being good. I'll tell you it's their part, their cue, as some folks call it, to beat us down, to swell their fortunes, and it's ours to stand up and fight hard, not for ourselves alone, but for them round about us, for justice and fair play. We help to make their profits, and we ought to help spend them. It's not that we want their brass so much this time, as we've done many a time afore. We'n getting money laid by, and we're resolved to stand and fall together. Not a man on us will go in for less wage than the union says is our due. So I say hooray for the strike, and let Thornton and Slickson and Hamper and their set look to it.
Thornton, said Margaret, Mr. Thornton of Marlborough Street.
Aye, Thornton of Marlborough Mill, as we call him.
He is one of the masters you are striving with, is he not? What sort of a master is he?
Did you ever see a bulldog? Set a bulldog on hind legs and dress him up in coat and breeches, and yon just getting John Thornton.
Nay, said Margaret, laughing, I deny that. Mr. Thornton is plain enough, but he's not like a bulldog, with its short broad nose and snarling upper lip.
No, not in luck, I grant you. But let John Thornton get hold on a notion, and he'll stick to it like a bulldog. You might pull him away with a pitchfork ere he'd leave go. He's worth fighting with, is John Thornton. As for Slickson, I take it, some of these days he'll wheedle his men back with fair promises. That they'll just get cheated out of as soon as they're in his power again. He'll work his fines well out on them, I'll warrant. He's as slippery as an eel, he is. He's like a cat, as sleek and cunning and fierce. It'll never be an honest up-and-down fight with him as it will be with Thornton. Thornton's as dour as a doornail, an obstinate chap, every inch on him, the old bulldog.
Poor Bessie, said Margaret, turning round to her. You sigh over it all. You don't like struggling and fighting as your father does, do you?
No, she said heavily. I'm sick on it. I could have wished to have had other talk about me in my latter days than just the clashing and clanging and clattering that has wearied a my life long, about work and wages and masters and hands and knobsticks.
Poor wench, latter days be farred. Thou'rt looking a sight better already for a little stir and change. Beside, I shall be a deal here to make it more lively for thee.
Tobacco smoke chokes me, said she querulously.
Then I'll never smoke no more in the house, he replied tenderly.
But why didst thou not tell me afore, thou foolish wench?
She did not speak for a while, and then so low that only Margaret heard her.
I reckon he'll want the comfort he can get out of either pipe or drink afore he's done.
Her father went out of doors, evidently to finish his pipe. Bessie said passionately,
Now am I not a fool? Am I not, miss?
There, I knew I ought but to keep father at home and away for the folk that are always ready for to tempt a man in time of strike to go drink. And there my tongue must needs quarrel with this pipe o' his, and he'll go off, I know he will, as often as he wants to smoke, and nobody knows where it'll end. I wish I'd letten myself be choked first.
"But does your father drink?" asked Margaret.
"No, not to say drink," replied she, still in the same wild, excited tone. "But what whin ye have? There are days wi' you, as wi' other folk, I suppose, when you get up and go through the hours just longing for a bit of a change, a bit of a fillip, as it were. I know I ha' gone and bought a 4-pounder out o' another baker's shop to common on such days, just because I sickened at the thought of going on forever with the same sight in my eyes, and the same sound in my ears, and the same taste in my mouth, and the same thought, or no thought for that matter, in my head, day after day forever. I've longed for to be a man to go spreeing, even if it were only a tramp to some new place in search of work. And, father, all men have it stronger in em than me to get tired of sameness and work forever. And what is em to do? It's little blame to them if they do go into the gin shop for to make their blood flow quicker and more lively, and see things they never see at no other time, pictures and looking-glass and such like. But father never was a drunkard, though maybe he's got worse for drink now and then. Only you see, and now her voice took a mournful pleading tone, at times a strike there's much to knock a man down, but all they start so hopefully. And where's the comfort to come from? He'll get angry and mad, they all do, and then they get tired out with being angry and mad, and maybe had done things in their passion they'd be glad to forget. Bless your sweet, pitiful face, but you do not know what a strike is yet.
Come, Bessie, said Margaret, I won't say you're exaggerating, because I don't know enough about it. But perhaps, as you're not well, you're only looking on one side, and there is another and a brighter to be looked to. It's all well enough for you to say so, who have lived in pleasant green places all your life long, and never known want or care, or wickedness either, for that matter.
Take care, said Margaret, her cheek flushing and her eye lightening, how you judge, Bessie. I shall go home to my mother, who is so ill, Bessie, that there's no outlet but death for her out of the prison of her great suffering. And yet I must speak cheerfully to my father, who has no notion of her real state, and to whom the knowledge must come gradually. The only person, the only one who could sympathize with me and help me, whose presence could comfort my mother more than any other earthly thing, is falsely accused, would run the risk of death if he came to see his dying mother. This I tell you, only you, Bessie. You must not mention it. No other person in Milton, hardly any other person in England, knows. Have I not care? Do I not know anxiety, though I go about well-dressed and have food enough? Oh, Bessie, God is just, and our lots are well portioned out by him, although none but he knows the bitterness of our souls.
I ask your pardon, replied Bessie humbly. Sometimes when I've thought of my life and the little pleasure I've had in it, I've believed that maybe I was one of those doomed to die by the falling of a star from heaven. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood, and men died of the waters because they were made bitter. One can bear pain and sorrow better if one thinks it has been prophesied long before for one. Somehow, then it seems as if my pain was needed for the fulfilment. Other ways it seems all sent for nothing.
Nay, Bessie, think, said Margaret, God does not willingly afflict. Don't dwell so much on the prophecies, but read the clearer parts of the Bible.
I dare say it would be wiser, but where would I hear such grand words of promise? Hear tell of anything so far different fro this dreary world and this town above us as in Revelations? Many's the time I've repeated the verses in the 7th chapter to myself, just for the sound. It's as good as an organ, and as different from every day, too. No, I cannot give up Revelations. It gives me more comfort than any other book in the Bible. Let me come and read you some of my favourite chapters.
Aye, said she greedily, come, father will maybe hear you. He's deaved with my talking. He says it's all naught to do with the things of today, and that's his business.
Where is your sister?
Gone fustian-cutting. I were loath to let her go, but somehow we must live, and the union can't afford us much. Now I must go. You have done me good, Bessie.
I done you good?
Yes, I came here very sad, and rather too apt to think my own cause for grief was the only one in the world. And now I hear how you have had to bear for years, and that makes me stronger. Bless you, I thought the good doing was on the side of gentlefolk. I shall get proud if I think I can do good to you.
You won't do it if you think about it, but you'll only puzzle yourself if you do. That's one comfort.
You're not like anyone I ever seed. I don't know what to make of you.
Nor I of myself. Goodbye.
Bessie stilled her rocking to gaze after her.
I wonder if there are many folk like her down south. She's like a breath of country air somehow. She freshens me up above a bit. Who'd have thought that face, as bright and as strong as the angel I dream of, could have known the sorrow she speaks on? I wonder how she'll sin. All on us must sin. I think a deal on her, for sure. But Father does the like, I see, and Mary even. It's not often who's stirred up to notice much.
Chapter 18. Likes and Dislikes. My heart revolts within me, and two voices make themselves audible within my bosom. Wallenstein. On Margaret's return home, she found two letters on the table. One was a note for her mother. The other, which had come by the post, was evidently from her Aunt Shaw, covered with foreign postmarks, thin, silvery, and rustling. She took up the other, and was examining it, when her father came in suddenly.
"So your mother is tired and gone to bed early. I'm afraid such a thundery day was not the best in the world for the doctor to see her. What did he say? Dixon tells me he spoke to you about her."
Margaret hesitated. Her father's looks became more grave and anxious.
"He does not think her seriously ill?"
"Not at present. She needs care, he says. He was very kind and said he would call again and see how his medicines worked."
"Only care? He did not recommend change of air. He did not say this smoky town was doing her any harm, did he, Margaret?"
"No, not a word," she replied gravely. "He was anxious, I think."
"Doctors have that anxious manner. It's professional," said he.
Margaret saw in her father's nervous ways that the first impression of possible danger was made upon his mind, in spite of all his making light of what she told him. He could not forget the subject, could not pass from it to other things. He kept recurring to it through the evening, with an unwillingness to receive even the slightest unfavourable idea, which made Margaret inexpressibly sad.
"This letter is from Aunt Shaw, Papa. She has got to Naples, and finds it too hot, so she has taken apartments at Sorrento. But I don't think she likes Italy."
"He did not say anything about diet, did he?"
"It was to be nourishing and digestible. Mama's appetite is pretty good, I think."
"Yes, and that makes it all the more strange he should have thought of speaking about diet."
"I asked him, Papa."
Another pause. Then Margaret went on.
"Aunt Shaw says she has sent me some coral ornaments, Papa, but," added Margaret, half smiling, "she's afraid the Milton dissenters won't appreciate them. She has got all her ideas of dissenters from the Quakers, has not she?"
"If ever you hear or notice that your mother wishes for anything, be sure you let me know. I am so afraid she does not tell me always what she would like. Pray see after that girl Mrs. Thornton named. If we had a good, efficient house servant, Dixon could be constantly with her, and I'd answer for it we'd soon set her up amongst us, if care will do it. She's been very much tired of late, with the hot weather and the difficulty of getting a servant. A little rest will put her quite to rights, eh, Margaret?"
"I hope so," said Margaret, but so sadly that her father took notice of it. He pinched her cheek.
"Come, if you look so pale as this, I must rouse you up a little. Take care of yourself, child, or you'll be wanting the doctor next."
But he could not settle to anything that evening.
He was continually going backwards and forwards on laborious tiptoe to see if his wife was still asleep. Margaret's heart ached at his restlessness, his trying to stifle and strangle the hideous fear that was looming out of the dark places of his heart. He came back at last, somewhat comforted. "She's awake now, Margaret. She quite smiled as she saw me standing by her, just her old smile, and she says she feels refreshed and ready for tea. Where's the note for her? She wants to see it. I'll read it to her while you make tea." The note proved to be a formal invitation from Mrs. Thornton to Mr., Mrs. and Miss Hale to dinner on the 21st instant. Margaret was surprised to find an acceptance contemplated, after all she had learnt of sad probabilities during the day. But so it was. The idea of her husband's and daughter's going to this dinner had quite captivated Mrs. Hale's fancy, even before Margaret had heard the contents of the note. It was an event to diversify the monotony of the invalid's life, and she clung to the idea of their going, with even fretful pertinacity when Margaret objected. "Nay, Margaret, if she wishes it, I'm sure we'll both go willingly. She never would wish it unless she felt herself really stronger, really better than we thought she was, eh, Margaret?" said Mr. Hale, anxiously, as she prepared to write the note of acceptance the next day. "Eh, Margaret?" questioned he, with a nervous motion of his hands. It seemed cruel to refuse him the comfort he craved for, and besides, his passionate refusal to admit the existence of fear almost inspired Margaret herself with hope. "I do think she is better since last night," said she. "Her eyes look brighter, and her complexion clearer."
"God bless you," said her father earnestly. "But is it true? Yesterday was so sultry everyone felt ill. It was a most unlucky day for Mr. Donaldson to see her on."
So he went away to his day's duties, now increased by the preparation of some lectures he had promised to deliver to the working people at a neighbouring lyceum. He had chosen ecclesiastical architecture as his subject, rather more in accordance with his own taste and knowledge than as falling in with the character of the place or the desire for particular kinds of information among those to whom he was to lecture. And the institution itself, being in debt, was only too glad to get a gratis course from an educated and accomplished man like Mr. Hale, let the subject be what it might.
"Well, Mother," asked Mr. Thornton that night, "who have accepted your invitations for the 21st?
"Fanny, where are the notes?"
"The Slicksons accept. Collingbrooks accept. Stevenses accept. Browns decline. Hales, father and daughter, come. Mother too great an invalid. McPherson's come, and Mr. Horsfall and Mr. Young. I was thinking of asking the Porters, as the Browns can't come."
"Very good. Do you know, I'm really afraid Mrs. Hale is very far from well, from what Dr. Donaldson says."
"It's strange of them to accept an invitation if she's very ill," said Fanny.
"I didn't say very ill," said her brother, rather sharply. "I only said very far from well. They may not know it either."
And then he suddenly remembered that from what Dr. Donaldson had told him, Margaret at any rate must be aware of the exact state of the case.
"Very probably they are quite aware of what you said yesterday, John, of the great advantage it would be to them, to Mr. Hale, I mean, to be introduced to such people as the Stevenses and the Collingbrooks. I'm sure that motive would not influence them. No, I think I understand how it is."
"John," said Fanny, laughing in her little weak, nervous way, "how you profess to understand these Hales, and how you never will allow that we can know anything about them. Are they really so very different to most people one meets with?"
She did not mean to vex him, but if she had intended it, she could not have done it more thoroughly. He chafed in silence, however, not deigning to reply to her question.
"They do not seem to me out of the common way," said Mrs. Thornton. "He appears a worthy kind of man enough, rather too simple for trade, so it's perhaps as well he should have been a clergyman first and now a teacher. She's a bit of a fine lady with her invalidism, and as for the girl, she's the only one who puzzles me when I think about her, which I don't often do. She seems to have a great notion of giving herself airs, and I can't make out why. I could almost fancy she thinks herself too good for a company at times, and yet they're not rich, from all I can hear. They never have been."
And she's not accomplished, Mama. She can't play.
Go on, Fanny. What else does she want to bring her up to your standard?
Nay, John, said his mother. That speech of Fanny's did no harm. I myself heard Miss Hale say she could not play. If you would let us alone, we could perhaps like her and see her merits.
I'm sure I never could, murmured Fanny, protected by her mother.
Mr. Thornton heard, but did not care to reply. He was walking up and down the dining room, wishing that his mother would order candles and allow him to set to work at either reading or writing, and so put a stop to the conversation. But he never thought of interfering in any of the small domestic regulations that Mrs. Thornton observed in habitual remembrance of her old economies.
Mother, said he, stopping and bravely speaking out the truth, I wish you would like Miss Hale.
Why? Asked she, startled by his earnest yet tender manner. You're never thinking of marrying her, a girl without a penny?
She would never have me, said he with a short laugh. No, I don't think she would, answered his mother.
She laughed in my face when I praised her for speaking out something Mr. Bell had said in your favour. I liked the girl for doing it so frankly, for it made me sure she had no thought of you, and the next minute she vexed me so by seeming to think... Well, never mind. Only you're right in saying she's too good an opinion of herself to think of you. The saucy jade. I should like to know where she'd find a better.
If these words hurt her son, the dusky light prevented him from betraying any emotion. In a minute he came up quite cheerfully to his mother, and putting one hand lightly on her shoulder, said,
Well, as I'm just as much convinced of the truth of what you have been saying as you can be, and as I have no thought or expectation of ever asking her to be my wife, you'll believe me for the future that I'm quite disinterested in speaking about her. I foresee trouble for that girl, perhaps want of motherly care, and I only wish you to be ready to be a friend to her in case she needs one. Now, Fanny, said he, I trust you have delicacy enough to understand that it is as great an injury to Miss Hale as to me. In fact, she would think it a greater... to suppose that I have any reason, more than I now give, for begging you and my mother to show her every kindly attention.
I cannot forgive her her pride, said his mother. I will befriend her, if there is need, for your asking, John. I would befriend Jezebel herself if you asked me. But this girl, who turns up her nose at us all, who turns up her nose at you...
Nay, mother... I have never put myself, and I mean never to put myself, within reach of her contempt.
Contempt, indeed! One of Mrs. Thornton's expressive snorts. Don't go on speaking of Miss Hale, John. If I've to be kind to her, when I'm with her, I don't know if I like or dislike her most. But when I think of her, and hear you talk of her, I hate her. I can see she's given herself airs to you, as well as if you'd told me out.
And if she has... said he, and then paused for a moment, then went on.
I'm not a lad to be cowed by a proud look from a woman, or to care for her misunderstanding me and my position. I can laugh at it.
To be sure, and at her, too, with her fine notions and haughty tosses.
I only wonder why you talk so much about her, then, said Fanny. I'm sure I'm tired enough of the subject.
Well, said her brother, with a shade of bitterness, suppose we find some more agreeable subject. What do you say to a strike, by way of something pleasant to talk about?
Have the hands actually turned out? Asked Mrs. Thornton with vivid interest.
Hamper's men are actually out. Mine are working out their week, through fear of being prosecuted for breach of contract. I'd have every one of them up and punished for it, that left his work before his time was out.
The law expenses would have been more than the hands themselves were worth. A set of ungrateful notes, said his mother.
To be sure. But I'd have shown them how I keep my word, and how I mean them to keep theirs. They know me by this time. Slickson's men are off. Pretty certain he won't spend money in getting them punished. We're in for a turnout, mother.
I hope there are not many orders in hand.
Of course there are. They know that well enough. But they don't quite understand all, though they think they do.
What do you mean, John?
Candles had been brought, and Fanny had taken up her interminable piece of worsted work, over which she was yawning, throwing herself back in her chair from time to time to gaze at vacancy and think of nothing at her ease.
Why, said he. "The Americans are getting their yarn so into the general market, but our only chance is producing them at a lower rate. If we can't, we may shut up shop at once, and hands and masters go alike on Trump. Yet these fools go back to the prices paid 3 years ago. Nay, some of their leaders quote Dickinson's prices now, though they know as well as we do that what with fines pressed out of